If you would like to turn to Matthew chapter 16, that's going to be the text for our study this morning. We're going to talk about Jesus today and talk about who Jesus is. In our 9 o'clock session, we're going to focus on some of the misconceptions that people had in Jesus' day. And of course, he addresses that with his disciples here in Matthew chapter 16. But then he concludes that little discussion, wanting them to focus on who he really is. So in our 10:50 lesson, we'll look more at what the scriptures teach about who Jesus really is. But this morning, I want us to think about some of the misconceptions that were floating around in Jesus' day. Why people tended maybe to misunderstand him. And the fact that some of the misunderstanding among people around us today may fall into, some of those people today may make similar mistakes that people in the first century made. In Matthew chapter 16, Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is? Who do men say that I am?" I think I mentioned in our bulletin this morning, I did some research. I stumbled over an article that a liberal theologian wrote, and it was obvious that he had no respect for the inspiration of the scriptures, probably didn't believe that there was anything divine about Jesus. He was just a man who had lived and so forth. And his take on Matthew chapter 16 was that Jesus was truly confused. Jesus was a little unsure of himself at this point in his ministry, and he wanted some feedback from his disciples. Just a ridiculous theory. Was Jesus really confused about his own identity? Was he unaware of the things that people around him believed? Was he really asking his disciples to gain information from them? If you studied the life of Jesus at all, if you studied his teachings, you know that Jesus asked a lot of questions. And most of the time when he asked a question, it was a question he already knew the answer to. It was a teaching technique, and we still use that technique today. Those of you who are teachers among us this morning know that. A lot of times the best technique to draw students into the discussion, make sure you have their understanding of the material, is to draw them and include them by asking them questions. Over in Mark chapter 11, verse 30, Jesus asked the Jewish leaders, "Was the baptism of John from heaven or from men?" You think Jesus didn't know whether the baptism of John was from God or not? But he asked that question to put them on the spot. And it was a teaching opportunity, not necessarily for the Jewish leaders, but for all the other people that were listening to the discussion that could see the inconsistency of these men. Over in John chapter 4, when Jesus was having that discussion with the woman at the well, the Samaritan woman, in verse 16, he came to a point in the discussion when he told that woman, "Go call your husband and come here." And she said, "Well, I don't have a husband." You think Jesus didn't know she had a husband? He knew she didn't have a husband. In fact, he said, "You're right. You don't have a husband. You've had three husbands, and the man you're living with now is not your husband." It was his opportunity to show her, "I'm not an ordinary man. I know things about you that nobody else, that I have no way of knowing unless there's something special about me." And she certainly got the point. Over in Matthew 9, verses 4 and 5, Jesus had told a lame man, "Your sins are forgiven." And nobody said anything, but he knew exactly what they're thinking. He said he knew what they were thinking. Jesus said to them, "I ask you, why are you thinking evil in your hearts? Which is easier to say, 'Your sins are forgiven,' or to say, 'Get up and walk?'" And of course he says, "Get up and walk." And a man gets up, takes up his bed and walks away. And it proved that if I have the ability to do this, I have the right to forgive sins. But he knew what they were thinking. Same thing in Luke chapter 6 with the man with the withered hand. He knew what those men were thinking before they ever said anything. And so when Jesus asked this question, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" he wanted his disciples to articulate the misconceptions of the masses. He wanted to hear it from them so that when he then prompted someone to give him a confession of the truth, they could see the stark contrast between all the confusion among the people and the truth about his true identity. It was a teaching technique that he used. And so we're going to focus on some of these prevailing theories in this lesson, then we'll talk about who Jesus really was in our 10:50. Okay? Now, our first one was, you know, John the Baptist. And if my handwriting is so bad you can't read it, I sympathize with you, but I'm in a hurry. You know, some say that you are John the Baptist, and that was certainly a prevalent theory that was going around. If you look over in Mark chapter 6, King Herod heard of these miracles that this man was going around doing. And of course, you got to remember, I know what Barack Obama looks like and I know what Donald Trump looks like because we have photographs, we see them plastered on the TV screen and on the newspapers. These people didn't have that kind of thing at their disposal. They hear about somebody across town that's doing a lot of things. Herod had never seen Jesus. Perhaps I know he had seen John the Baptist, but he hadn't seen Jesus. And some of these people have maybe not seen both men in the same place at the same time. And so King Herod hears about Jesus' miracles, for his name had become well known. This is verse 14 of Mark 6. His name had become well known, and people were saying, John the Baptist has risen from the dead, and that is why these miraculous powers are at work in him. Down in verse 16, when Herod heard of it, he kept saying, John, whom I beheaded, has risen. He knew John was dead. He had had his head removed from his body because of his wicked wife and stepdaughter. And so he knew John was dead. And I don't know if there was some compunction of conscience at work here, but he certainly went along with some of the rumors that were going around. This man who's doing these amazing things must be John the Baptist. And then some people believe, Lord, that you are Elijah. Where in the world would they get an impression that Elijah would be here in the first century in their day and time? Well, they would get that from the book of Malachi. In the very last two verses of the Old Testament, before that 400-year blackout of the revelation of God to prophets. And so Malachi says in Malachi 4, verses 5 and 6, God said, behold, I'm going to send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. He will restore the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers so that I will not come and smite the land with a curse. And so I'm going to send Elijah before the great and terrible day of the Lord. And the people were looking for him. You recall in Matthew chapter 17 when Peter, James, and John witnessed the transfiguration of Jesus, and Moses and Elijah were there on the same occasion, and they were having a discussion about the impending death of Jesus. And after that whole event was over, his disciples said to Jesus, it says, after seeing Elijah on the Mount of Transfiguration, his disciples said to Jesus, why then do the scribes say that Elijah must come first? The scribes, the lawyers, the students of the Bible of Jesus' day had been reading Malachi, and they were watching for Elijah to come in some sense. And so they were watching for him, and they were trying to make some sense out of that. Now, Elijah did come before the great and terrible day of the Lord, just like Malachi said, but the Jewish leaders failed to recognize him as well. Down in verses 12 and 13 of Matthew 17, Jesus, partly in response to the inquiry of his disciples, said, I say to you that Elijah already came. And they did not recognize him, but did to him whatever they wished. So also the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands. Then the disciples understood that he spoke to them about John the Baptist. John the Baptist was Elijah who was to come to prepare the way before the great and terrible coming of the Lord. And he certainly did. And they rejected him just like they rejected Jesus. And then he said, one of the prophets. Perhaps Jeremiah or one of the other prophets was another theory that was floating around. You know, I think it's a testament and it's a tribute to the impression that Jesus made on these people. This is not just a good man. This was not just a great man. This was not just a man that maybe God had begun to prophesy through in our day and time. There was something so awesome and so impressive about Jesus of Nazareth that their thinking went back to the reincarnation of, the bringing back of one of the famous prophets of old, whether that's Elijah or Elisha or one of the other great prophets, Isaiah. I mean, there's something special about Jesus. They may not have understood exactly who he was, what he was about, but that's where their minds went. Now, if you'd like, jump over to John chapter 7. We'll spend a few minutes in John chapter 7 together, because I think there are some other impressions that people had that the disciples happened not to enumerate when Jesus asked the question in Matthew 16. But over in John chapter 7, tells us about some of this discussion among the Jews about who Jesus might be. And some of the people, therefore, when they heard these words, they heard some of Jesus' teaching, were saying, "This certainly is the prophet." And my translation has prophet capitalized, and that is not an accident. Not a prophet, he is the prophet. Others were saying, "This is the Christ." Still others were saying, "Surely the Christ is not going to come from Galilee, is he? Has not the scripture said that Christ comes from the descendants of David and from Bethlehem, the village where David was?" So a division occurred in the crowd because of him. And so some were saying, "Well, he's the prophet." Well, what prophet are you talking about? Well, if you go over to Deuteronomy chapter 18, you find out. In Deuteronomy 18 and verse 15, Moses told the Israelite people before he left them, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your countrymen. You shall listen to him." And if you jump down to verses 18 and 19, this is God speaking to Moses. He said, "I will raise up a prophet from among their countrymen like you, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. It shall come about that whoever will not listen to my words, which he shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him." Now, what's interesting is you have two crowds of people here. You have the prophet crowd and you have the Christ crowd. And what's ironic in this whole situation is, number one, they're both correct to an extent. And number two, they thought they were on different sides and they're talking about the very same man. Jesus of Nazareth was the prophet that God had promised through Moses that I'm going to raise up from among their countrymen. And if they don't listen to him, I'm going to require it of them if they don't listen to that prophet. Jesus was that prophet, and he was also the Christ, the Messiah, that would fulfill all of those messianic prophecies of Isaiah and Jeremiah and others. And so he was both the prophet of Deuteronomy 18 and the Messiah. Now, even those who accepted Jesus as Messiah had misconceptions about him. Okay, they were looking for a different kind of man to come along that would accomplish different things than what they expect than what Jesus was doing. But there were some who were accepting the fact that he was Messiah. I would put the prophet and the Christ not because they're misconceptions in actuality, but because these people had serious misconceptions about who they're even dealing with. They didn't recognize that Jesus was both. And then I would suggest that some people were, at least whether they believed it truly or not, but they were certainly saying it about him, was that he was a gluttonous drunkard. You say, how in the world could somebody ever believe that Jesus of Nazareth, in his purity, in his peaceful nature, and in his righteous living, how could they accuse him of being a gluttonous man and a drunkard? But look at Matthew chapter 11 and begin reading with me in verse 16. Jesus is talking about this unbelieving generation, this generation of Jews who were rejecting Messiah when God sent him. But he said, "To whom shall I compare this generation? It is like children sitting in the marketplaces who call out to other children and say, 'We played the flute for you and you did not dance. Or we sang a dirge and you did not mourn.'" Now, whether that was a game kids played at the time, I don't know, almost like, Simon Says and Mother May I and those guys, I don't know. But he said that, this generation like a bunch of kids. And, we played the flute and you didn't dance. And we sang a dirge and you didn't mourn. You didn't behave the way we thought you ought to behave. John came neither eating or drinking, and they say he has a demon. This guy's mad. He's out in the wilderness someplace wearing, you know, a leather girdle and eating, you know, locusts and wild honey. And I mean, there's something wrong with that guy, you know, but he had very austere lifestyle. And yet the Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, behold, a gluttonous man and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Yet wisdom is vindicated by her deeds. You're going to decide what you want to believe. And it doesn't matter if it's John the Baptist that God sent to you or whether it's Messiah that God sent to you. You're going to decide what you want to believe, and you're going to reject anything you don't want to accept. It doesn't matter what the evidence says. You're going to try to justify your own lack of wisdom, your own poor decisions. A gluttonous drunkard. And again, I'm not sure that any of this may have just been disingenuous slander. I'm not sure that anybody really believed that about Jesus, but they would say, it's like some in politics today, they would say anything bad about him that they could think to say. And then they accused him of being a blasphemer. Why in the world would they do that? Well, look over at John chapter 8. John chapter 8, beginning in verse 56. Now, Jesus was either who he claimed to be, or he was a blasphemer. I will give that to him. And Muslims and others today say, well, Jesus never really claimed to be divine. That's something his disciples came up with after his death. That's nonsense. Over there in John chapter 8, begin reading in verse 56. Jesus was having this lengthy discussion with these people, and he said, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. And that threw him for a loop. The Jews said, you're not yet 50 years old. Have you seen Abraham? It was kind of a rhetorical, kind of a chiding question. Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was born, I am. And they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself, went out of the temple. These people are trying to stone him to death for poor grammar? No. The only being in history that had ever used the phrase, I am, was Jehovah God to Moses out of the burning bush. Moses, I want you to go lead my people out of the land of Egypt. And Moses starts with the excuses. Oh, Lord, I'm not very articulate. Oh, Lord, I'm just not your man for whatever reason. And when I go talk to him and they ask me, who is this that you represent? Who is this God that sent you with this message? God said, you tell them that I am sent you. And later, in a couple of verses later, he called himself the I am. I am. I exist. I am because no matter where in the continuum of existence you want to look, I'm there. I am. And by the way, you have no right to even question who I am. I am that I am. That's what you tell them. That's who you're dealing with. And Jesus says, before Abraham was, I am. They knew exactly what he meant. Here's a man using the phrase that only Jehovah God has ever used. And you know why he used it? Because he's God. That's why he had the right to use it. He claimed to be divine. And these people recognized that and tried to stone him for it. Over in Matthew chapter 9, verses 2 and 3, when Jesus was talking to the paralytic, he said, take courage, son, your sins are forgiven. And some of the scribes said to themselves, this fellow blasphemed. Nobody has the right to forgive sins except God, and that's exactly right. And God was forgiving sins on this occasion. He was the embodiment of the Godhead. He was the fullness of the Godhead bodily, and he knew it, and he claimed that for himself. But they accused him of blasphemy. And then they accused him of being, and I'm just going to word this as a servant of, and I'm going to put Satan just because it's shorter to spell. But, you know, they accused him of being the servant of Beelzebul. If you look over Matthew chapter 12. Beginning in verse 22, there's a demon-possessed man there who was blind and mute, and they brought him to Jesus, and he healed him. Well, they got a crowd standing around watching. He heals this man. All of a sudden, now the fellow can hear, and he can speak, and he can see. And all the crowds were amazed and were saying, this man cannot be the son of David, can he? Maybe that's who it is. Maybe this is the descendant of David that's supposed to sit on David's throne. But when the Pharisees heard this, they said, "This man casts out demons only by Beelzebul, the ruler of the demons." Can't deny what he's doing. And so we have to fabricate some sort of weak, lame excuse or explanation for how in the world he ought to be able to do that. And of course, you know, Jesus explains why in the world would the ruler of the demons attack his own house by casting out his own servants. Just doesn't make it. A house divided against itself cannot stand. Bub meant fly. Beelzebub was Lord of the Flies, and this Beelzebul, B-O-U-L, was of Aramaic origin, and it was an insulting name for Satan. It was like the dung god, you know. It was like calling Satan the dung god, and so they used that term to refer to him in an insulting way. And yet what they're saying is, this man's not a servant of God, he's an agent of Satan. And so Satan's the one that's giving him the ability to do these things. So we have people going around saying, well, he's John the Baptist, or he's Elijah, or he's one of the prophets, or maybe he is the prophet that Moses talked about. Maybe he's the Christ. He's a gluttonous drunkard, a blasphemer, a servant of Beelzebul. Now, the question is, you know, what do these impressions that people have tell us about Messiah and about their reaction to him? OK, why in the world would they come to conclusions like that? Okay? First of all, I believe that many of those people were blinded by preconceived notions. We saw that in Jesus' little discussion in Luke chapter 7. They're like children sitting in the marketplace saying, "We played the flute for you and you didn't dance. And then we sang a dirge and you didn't mourn." I mean, you're not living up to what our preconceived expectations and notions of what Messiah ought to be. We want somebody riding in on a white horse that's going to lead us up to Rome and throw off the shackles of Roman oppression and sit on David's throne in the city of Jerusalem, bring back the glory days. That's what we're looking for. And you're walking around talking about peace and service and spiritual applications of the prophecies and so forth, not what we're looking for. They were blinded by their preconceived notions. And then they judged by human traditions. Jesus said, don't judge by appearances, judge by with righteous judgment. These people were judging him not based on the law of God, not based on the facts and the evidence that were given, but because of the teachings of their elders and the traditions of their elders. Here's a man who's violating the tradition of the elders. How in the world can he be a man of God? He's a sinner. He's working on the Sabbath day. By whose definition? Okay. Well, by the tradition of the elders, of course. And you can't go around healing people. Now, I'll pull my ox out of a hole on the Sabbath day to rescue him. But if Jesus rescues a man who's been lame all of his life on the Sabbath, that's a sin and the other's not. Jesus showed their inconsistency to them. But you're not meeting up to the tradition of the elders. He doesn't wash his hands before he eats in some ceremonial way like the elders said he should. He and his disciples eat grain right off the top of the stalks of wheat, you know, on the Sabbath day, and they're walking through the wheat fields and they're grabbing the grain and rolling their hands and eating them. But somehow that's different from me picking the food up off my fork on the Sabbath and putting it in my mouth. One's a sin and the other one's not. I mean, they were using human tradition to judge him by, and it was not righteous judgment. It was unrighteous judgment. And then they preferred the status quo. They wanted to keep things just like they liked things the way they were. They wanted to keep them. You look over in John chapter 11. I believe this was right after Jesus had raised Lazarus from the dead. I'd have to go back and look again. But Jesus had done something of note that really had them stirred up. And so in verse 47, the chief priests and the Pharisees convened a council and were saying, "What are we doing? What are we doing? Look at all the evidence this guy's given us. He's obviously the Messiah. What are we doing? We ought to accept him." Is that what they said? No. What are we doing? This man is performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, All men will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. We like it like it is. We're at the pinnacle. They're at least letting us run things in the city of Jerusalem. We can run around in our fancy robes and act pious and religious and lord it over all these fellow Jews here in the city. We like things the way they are, and he's going to mess things up. He's going to get the Romans riled up because he's actually performing all these wonderful miracles. Everybody's going to believe in him, and he's going to cause political problems for them. That was their concern. But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man die for the people and that the whole nation not perish." Don't you see the solution to the problem? We just get rid of this one guy and we got it made. We can keep things like they are. We can maintain the status quo. That's what's important to us. And they were so blinded by that, they were even complaining about the miracles he's performing instead of seeing the message behind it. Nicodemus said, "No one could do the things you do if God weren't with him." He got the right message, and these fellows are too blind to see it. And then finally, they love the approval of men more than they love the approval of God. Jesus told us that, or John told us in the Gospel of John chapter 12, beginning in verse 42, John said, "Nevertheless, many even of the rulers believed in him, but because of the Pharisees, they were not confessing him for fear that they would be put out of the synagogue, for they loved the approval of men rather than the approval of God." Had their priorities out of order. It's more important to them to fit in their neighborhood and fit in down at the local synagogue and for people to pat them on the back and say, "Yeah, you're one of our brothers and, you know, we love you," and so forth. They didn't want to be ostracized because they had the audacity to follow this man Jesus, and they know good and well that the evidence is overwhelming. They know he's the Messiah that had been promised, and yet they knew if they followed Jesus, they'd get thrown out of the synagogue. Their neighbors would shun them. They'd be ostracized. They just couldn't handle the pressure, and so I'm going to keep my mouth shut. These are people that were among the rulers of Jesus' day that refused to confess him because it was too important to them to maintain their position in their community. They wanted the approval of men more than the approval of God. Now, what about us? I think, of course, there were things that were unique in their culture that are not as much of a problem for us. But I think in a general way, we can fall victim to some of the same things. We can be blinded by preconceived notions. We're raised, Jordan and I were having a study the other night, and we were talking about the challenge of studying the scriptures and try to have as clear glasses on as we possibly can. All of us kind of have rose-colored glasses on. We were all raised in 21st century or 20th century America, and we tend to read things and filter that through who we are and how we were raised and our culture. We got to be careful about that. We got to do the best we can to ascertain what the will of the Lord is and take it for what it is and not twist it and adjust it to get it to fit my culture. And I think sometimes we can do that if we're not careful. We don't need to judge by human tradition, whether that's the religion of my family, whether it's unreliable information, you know, from people who are supposed to be religious leaders. Maybe they've got a degree from a seminary someplace. And so we judge who Jesus is and the nature of his teachings and what that teaching means to my life after it's been filtered through all these traditions that we get from outside sources. Unreliable information. And if we're not careful, we can allow that to color our thinking. And then sometimes we may prefer the status quo. You know, change is difficult. It really is. And I was in quality for years and years when I was in industry and business. And I will tell you, anybody that knows me will tell you, I am not for change for the sake of change. And I've seen people that are like that. They think they're doing the good job on the job, but they're constantly changing things. What they're changing to may not be any better, but at least it's different. I'm sorry, I don't go for that. But I'll tell you, there's changes that need to be made in my life when I find that my life doesn't measure up to the mirror that James talked about, and look in the perfect law of liberty and go fix things that aren't right. We need to make changes, and it's not comfortable. It's difficult. It's sort of human nature to want to get in a comfort zone and stay there, you know. And we can be antagonistic toward the Jewish leadership of Jesus' day, but we can get into the same thing if we're not careful. I've got to be willing to make sacrifices and make changes, even though it's not comfortable. And then it's real easy to love the approval of men. And you know, there's nothing inherently wrong with that. I think we're social beings. We like to be liked. We like to enjoy other people's company and that kind of thing. But if I'm seeking the approval of men above the approval of God, that's where the problem comes in. And I've got to decide where my priorities are. These people made the wrong decisions. And we need to make the right decisions for the right reasons. If you're here and you're not a Christian, we're going to be talking about Jesus today and how badly all of us need him. And we need to be open-minded. If you're not a Christian, you need to be open-minded. Don't listen to the wrong voices. Don't listen to misinformation. Simply accept what the scriptures have to teach you about Jesus, what he came for, and why you need him so badly. If you're still in sin, you need forgiveness of that, and only the blood of Jesus can grant it. We can help you be baptized into Christ this morning if that's your desire. For those of us who are Christians, I think we can learn some things today as we go through our study. Make sure that we try to be objective as we study the scriptures, have the proper attitude, and put his will first. If there's sin in your life, get rid of that. We want to help you if we can. If you're subject to the invitation, come forward and let us know while we stand together and sing.